Good morning. Please be seated. This is the time set for oral arguments for the Northern Panel for September 18, 2013. The first case to be heard by the panel is State of Nevada versus Jarvis Cansey, case number 59121. Are counsel ready to go? Mr. Right here, Mr. Fry.
Yes, sir.
All right, Mr. Breyer.
May it please the court, my name is Joe Plato. I represent the State of Nevada Council. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This is an appeal from a district court order granting a motion to suppress. And it's a case where we just want to present all the relevant evidence and the relevant legal theory at a suppression hearing. Because the district courts have a responsibility to make correct rulings based on the most accurate picture of facts and legal theory at a suppression hearing. And the public has a right to expect that as well. More specifically, this case asks, what evidence or legal theory do we have to give notice of to a defendant before a suppression hearing? And what happens when a police officer stops somebody and cites him for breaking the law, and the person actually breaks the law, but the officer cites the person under the wrong legal or under the wrong statute? The case arose when Deputy Jason of the Washoe County Sheriff's Office and Mr. Cansey were driving on a street in opposite directions. The deputy saw a cracked windshield on Mr. Cansey's car, and the crack, according to the deputy, went all the way across the windshield. She pulled the defendant over based on the cracked windshield. She smelled alcohol about the defendant. She administered a couple of field sobriety tests. He failed those. He failed a preliminary breath test, and he was arrested for felony DUI. He was also arrested for violating NRS 484D.435. And that prohibits anybody from driving a vehicle that has a non-transparent material on the windshield that obstructs a driver's clear view. So Mr. Cansey filed a motion to suppress. And the basis of the motion was that Mr. Cansey's windshield did not have any obstruction on it. He didn't violate NRS 484.435 because a cracked windshield cannot, as a matter of law, constitute a non-transparent material on the windshield as prohibited by the statute. So we pleaded that that statute did apply, and we went to the hearing and we argued the applicability of that statute. But we also raised the idea that there was another statute that prohibited Mr. Cansey's conduct, or the broken windshield, and that was 484B.163. And that prohibits any vehicle from being on a highway unless the vision through the operating glass equipment is normal.
On that point, Mr. Plater, I'd like to clarify the record as to the officer's testimony. My understanding is that he testified the crack was 6 to 8 inches in length and horizontal across the windshield, but not in front of the driver. Is that correct?
No. The officer testified.
What's your understanding?
The officer testified at the suppression hearing that the crack went all the way across the windshield, and that was the basis for the arrest.
Well, I thought the testimony was that it was 6 to 8 inches, and there wasn't a very specific testimony whether or not it obstructed the driver's view. I don't think she could recall that.
She testified at the hearing the crack went all the way across the windshield, and she said the photographs are consistent with that. Now, on cross-examination, Mr. Fry asked the deputy, isn't it true that at some prior time you told somebody that the crack was 6 to 8 inches, and she said yes. So she didn't say, it's a distinction here, but she didn't say at the hearing, yes, the crack is 6 to 8 inches across. She admitted that was a prior statement that she had made about the length of the crack. And there was no testimony about whether the crack was obstructing a normal view of the road from somebody that was driving within the vehicle at all. We didn't even get that far. That was never brought out. Although Judge Hardy, in his order, ruled there's no evidence that it affected the field of vision of the driver. And
how well was that fleshed out during the hearing that there was a reasonable, articulable suspicion that there was some crime committed?
Well, the district court judge, Judge Hardy, never made a finding one way or the other that this officer did or didn't have an articulable suspicion. That was never ruled on. What was presented, as I said, was the officer took the stand. She said she saw the car driving in the opposite direction. As she saw the car pass, she saw a crack on the windshield, and she said the crack went all the way across. Now, and our contention is that under 484.163, that constitutes at least a reasonable suspicion that the crack might affect the normal vision of a person who's operating a car, and the car might be unsafe. Now, the officer did testify why that might be unsafe, and she said there were two reasons. Number one, if the sun hit a crack like that, it could, in essence, create such glare that it would affect your safe operation of the car. Or number two, a crack like that, if it were hit by some object, could shatter the glass. It endangered the driver and hence anyone else who was in the car or in the immediate vicinity of the car on the street. So those are the only facts that were brought out in terms of what the crack was and whether there was an articulable suspicion to validate a Terry stop. But our position would be that even if the crack were only 68 inches, that in and of itself would be sufficient cause to conduct a Terry stop. As the court is aware, all we need under a Terry stop is an articulable suspicion that the defendant or the suspect has broken the law, is about to break the law, or will break the law, and that we can stop to investigate those possibilities. And whether or not the investigation shows that the defendant actually broke the law is not the relevant question in a Terry stop.
So let me ask you, if it's a 6 to 8 inch crack, what if it's starting under the rearview mirror and going this direction? Does that still give the officer reasonable suspicion to stop?
It could, Your Honor, because...
What law is broken?
484B.163.
Which says what?
The vision of a driver driving a car on a highway has to be normal.
So if it's over here and not within the field of sight, how does that break the law?
It breaks the law because your assumption is that within the field of sight is only that part of the windshield that you happen to be using at that particular point, or that a driver normally uses when he's driving down the road. Our position is the field of vision constitutes the entire windshield, and it has to, because at any given point, something may distract the driver through the most remote part of the windshield, and you have to be able to have a clear vision through every part of the windshield to be able to anticipate and react to things that might distract you at any point in the field of vision of the entire windshield. For example, you're driving down the highway and you see a flock of birds, you see a moose, you see an animal about to cross the road.
A moose in Reno?
Okay, in Yellowstone.
Okay.
You see a dog or a cat coming across the road through the periphery of your vision, the extreme end of the windshield. You have to be able to see that in order to drive your car safely and take evasive action if necessary. So the district court in this case granted the motion to suppress for several reasons. First of all, Judge Hardy said that the stop was based on a mistake of law, that this officer stopped Mr. Cansey for violating 484D.435. And that was wrong because the crack did not constitute a non-transparent material under that statute. And so since the officer incorrectly cited him for violating a statute that he didn't violate, the stop is invalid. And we agree with that. We agree with the idea that if an officer stops you based on a false set of facts, that the stop is invalid and it can't be justified. There's some contrary authority that we've both cited from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. But essentially, if an officer stops somebody and cites somebody for violating a particular statute, but the facts show that absolutely no statute was violated, then the stop's invalid. And that's what Judge Hardy ruled. We don't take issue with that. We just say that there was another statute that applied to this case, and that the rule that the court should adopt is something that's known by some courts as a mistake of fact doctrine, And that is where if an officer sees some activity and stops somebody or arrests somebody and cites somebody for violating a particular statute that doesn't apply to that factual situation, the stop or arrest can still be validated if the facts by themselves, viewed objectively, show that the suspect actually violated some other statute. And that's what we argue happened in this case.
What about the issue of credibility? I'm reading Judge Hardy's order, and it looks like, although he didn't say it outwardly, it seems that he hinted that there was a credibility problem with the officer.
Well,
don't you have a right in a motion to suppress as a district court judge to take credibility into your analytics as to why a motion to suppress should be granted?
Sure. That's what a district court judge does.
Right. And what's our burden here? What's our review, standard of review for this as to the credibility issue?
Well, of course, you would defer to the district court judge if he made a credibility finding regarding a certain witness's testimony. And in fact, in support of his order, Judge Hardy did say, he said, he in essence found the deputy did not believe that Mr. Cansey had violated another statute. Our response is, doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. Doesn't matter what the judge found or what the officer was thinking about when he pulled over Mr. Cansey and cited him. The subjective thinking of the officer as to what statute Mr. Cansey violated and whether he actually violated some other statute is completely irrelevant.
But there's an issue here about the wrong statute, the issue about 6 to 8 inches, whether it blocked the view, the issue of whether the car was not it, why the car wasn't impounded if it was such a safety factor. I mean, it looks like Judge Hardy just didn't conclude that the officer was up front with this stop.
Judge Hardy did find, he said, because it's the extent of the crack is unclear, because the deputy didn't impound the car according to county policy, and maybe there was one other fact, he concluded that the extent of the crack was unclear. And if we don't know what the extent of the crack was, then the state has essentially failed to meet its burden of proving a constitutional stop. But the relevance of Judge Hardy's finding about the extent of the crack was based on his idea that the crack had to be in the field of vision of the driver. That's where he said the state had failed to meet its burden. In essence, he's saying the state hasn't shown that this crack is in the field of vision of the driver. And so what he's doing is he's equating the field of vision of the driver within the normal distance that one uses when one's driving a car of the windshield that he's driving. I didn't make that very clear. But he essentially said the field of vision.
He's narrowed the
field of vision to a particular distance on the windshield. When we say the field of vision constitutes the entire windshield.
What you're arguing is that if I understand it correctly, is that the appropriate test here should have been whether there was reasonable suspicion for the officer when driving, when encountering Cansey, that there was a violation, a traffic violation, that warranted the stop.
That's right.
The citation of the wrong statute doesn't alter those facts. If, in fact, there is a statute that governs.
That's right, Your Honor. And that's the majority position.
There are two important aspects of this case I wanted you to address, and we'll add some time. But first, the judge appeared to be take exception to the late citation of the applicable statute and imposed as a sanction, I guess, although without saying so, that you couldn't rely on the statute that you felt was appropriate. And the other decision the court made was to exclude or not permit photographs of the windshield, apparently because those two were not attached as exhibits. I'm concerned from a legal standpoint and for guidance of district courts about the appropriateness of each of those orders, whether this court should provide some direction when a statute is cited during a hearing in a suppression
hearing, what should occur, and secondly, what's the appropriate review and decision when the photographs are excluded? Should, for example, the hearing have been continued rather than the photos excluded?
And that's part of our argument why the factual findings of the district court are suspect in this case, because Judge Hardy didn't let us present all the relevant evidence. Some of that evidence were the photographs that we've alluded to. And according to us, the photograph will show that the crack extended all the way across the windshield. At least that's what the deputy testified to.
Well, and I guess that's where it bothers me a little bit, because that was one of the bases for excluding it was the fact that it was late disclosed.
Well,
and he indicated that, among other reasons, he was bothered also by the fact that the photographs were taken after briefing was closed, after some period of time had passed.
What the record shows is that Ms. Noble, the prosecutor, gave the photographs to Mr. Fry after she filed an opposition to the motion to suppress and before the hearing. Cansey had the photographs before the hearing. Now, in connection with that, there's no prejudice. If they got the, even if there were some rule that we had to attach these as exhibits to our opposition, and I don't see that there's any rule that requires us to do that, or that there's any sanction that would prohibit us from using those photographs, even if we were required to attach them to an opposition. He had the photographs, and he couldn't, neither Cansey nor the district court could articulate any prejudice to him. Now, he did say, oh, I had some witnesses that we were going to try to get here at the hearing, and they can't be here today. But the fact that they weren't there was never connected to the fact that we somehow disclosed these photographs to them in an untimely way.
And he really didn't explore the foundation for them as to when they were taken and whether there was a period of time that elapsed. That wasn't explored?
No. We don't know when they were taken, why they were taken, under what circumstances. And so the probative value of the photograph seems to be extremely minimal in our view at best. But we don't know of any rule that provides that we had to attach those as exhibits to an opposition in a motion to suppress hearing, or that we had to provide every legal doctrine in our written points and authorities before the hearing that we couldn't allude to at the hearing at some point. And the idea is that, look, the district court's got to be able to rely on proper law to make these decisions. Regardless of where the source of law comes from, the district court has a duty to properly evaluate a motion to suppress and apply all applicable law, regardless of where it comes from. I mean, if I could give you an example, what would happen if we get to a suppression hearing and neither the defense nor the prosecution realizes what the real applicable statute is that would apply? And it would be a dispositive statute in deciding a motion to suppress. But the district court comes up with the answer. Can the defendant then raise his hand and say, well, I object, that's not fair. I didn't have notice that the district court was going to cite some legal authority that would resolve this issue. And so therefore the court can't rely on it. Well, we wouldn't buy into that argument, because the court has an obligation to get it right. And that's all we're suggesting here today. That the court has the obligation to use all relevant evidence and all relevant theory in deciding these things.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Player at this time? All right, you'll have 2 minutes on rebuttal. And Mr. Frey, you have 17 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Good morning, and may it please the court. The only appropriate disposition in this case is affirmance, and there are three reasons for that. Number one, once you couple the waiver determination of the district court with the mistake of law determination, then you'll find that the mistake of law determination was not only correct, but it was compelled, because there never can be an instance in which an objectively reasonable or unreasonable mistake of law can justify a traffic stop. Second, the waiver determination was not only a permissible exercise of discretion, but once you look at this record closely, it was an understandable and a correct one given the litigation choices made by the state at the suppression hearing. Finally, remand would serve no purpose in this case, and we understand that to be the request of the appellant, because the record with respect to the only rationale that wasn't waived in this case, the safety rationale, was developed in materially the same way that the record would have been developed had NRS 484B163 not been deemed waived. So to the extent that remand is appropriate for further factual development in the record, it wouldn't serve a purpose here. There are some questions, and hopefully I can answer those questions when I go through my argument, but I want to point out what I think is a critical tension in the case, and that is with respect to how waiver interacts with the mistake of law doctrine. The state makes the claim based upon a general proposition that citation of the wrong statute is immaterial when there's a right statute that exists, and therefore a traffic stop can be upheld on an alternative basis. That seems to be what the state considers to be the general rule. The authorities seem to support that as a general proposition, but the state's insistence on the general rule prevents it from seeing that this case is the exception, because the alternative statutory rationales were waived, confining the analysis that the district court had to perform to only one law, that was 484D435. With only that law before it, it could only make the only available ruling that it could, which was that that simply did not cover the conduct of Mr. Cansey.
Well, that wasn't the only statute in front of it. The state raised that second statute during the hearing. Why isn't that appropriate? And if your client has a problem or you need to address it, you continue the hearing so you can come back and address it. I don't quite understand your point there.
Well, assuming that the waiver determination is upheld by this court, then the only analysis that this court needs to do.
What's the legal basis for finding that the state waived the right to identify for the district court judge at the hearing the correct statute? That's odd to me. If one is in a hearing in a criminal case, in any kind of case, and cites authority to the court that wasn't contained in their written papers, they're waived even if that authority is applicable? Where is there a rule or a case that says that?
Your Honor, the district court has the inherent authority to control litigation that comes before it. This is a principle of law that I think it's fair to say is probably as old as the law itself. It's governs.
If so, I would assume there would be some case somewhere in America that holds that if either party identifies an applicable statute during a hearing before the ruling's made, that they're waived because they didn't put it in their written papers.
Well, I refer you to the citations that are contained, I think, page 5 of our answering brief. And there's a string citation to cases where...
But all of those cases, I have those, relate to really a recitation of the general rule of mistake of law. They don't recite the rule I'm asking you to identify, which is that if you cite a statute that wasn't in your written papers, you're precluded from doing so, and you've waived the right to do so.
When you look at those cases, what you can infer from those cases is that the fact that they deemed other alternative statutory grounds as being waived and prohibited the state from arguing those statutes, that is a permissible power and one that the district court could exercise, and which it did exercise in this case. Notably, Justice Hardesty, Mr. Cansey didn't put the district court in a position where he couldn't intelligently decide the issues. Mr. Cansey did not put himself in the position where he should have been required to ask for a continuance. The prejudice here was caused by one party, and that was the state, because its pleading practices were simply deficient. Mr. Cansey gave the state 42 days of notice to file an opposition, to locate a relevant statute that may be alternative to the one cited by the officer, and the state simply fell down on its burden. And I think the burden issue is an important one, because there's only one burden with respect to a motion to suppress, and that rests with the state. I would respectfully disagree with the contention that the district court somehow has some sort of sua sponte duty to, with all due respect, do the work of a prosecutor. I believe that we are all litigants, and when Mr. Cansey comes into the court, he is just as much a litigant as the state is. If the state cannot carry its burden, then it should suffer the consequences, and that was the district court's ruling. The prejudice with respect to the pleading practice of the state, I think, is absolutely clear. You can see from the record that Mr. Cansey couldn't arrange for rebuttal witnesses. If indeed they were going to argue for 484B163 and that there was some sort of vision impairment as a result, then Mr. Cansey should have been able to find, for example, the owner of the vehicle who could testify as to its condition.
Wouldn't a continuance be appropriate in that case as opposed to granting a motion to suppress
Well, Your Honor, I think that every time a continuance is contemplated, it should be contemplated at the request of a party. Notably, it was not requested by the state, but yet the state is here asking for a remand to get the continuance that it never requested below. It should have requested it because the waiver determination was absolutely inevitable once you see the progression in the colloquy between the district court judge and the prosecutor, where the district court judge is attempting as best as he can to elicit some sort of legal rationale, some sort of factual basis why he should uphold this stop. And the prosecutor says, you know what, Your Honor, all I have is NRS 484D435, and I know you're not buying that.
How was your client prejudiced by the citation by the state to an applicable statute?
I've mentioned the lack of rebuttal witnesses, but I think it's really important to note that once a new statute comes into play, the defendant should have an opportunity to brief the applicability of that statute. It's not just assumed that statute applies. There's a statutory construction that could be alternative to the state's that Mr. Cansey could have supplied.
Did the defense request a continuance so it could brief the statute? Was there an offer of proof made as to the nature of the testimony that witnesses would be called to address the applicable statute?
There was no request from the defense, and we respectfully submit that it wasn't our obligation to request a continuance, the need for which was precipitated by the state. Second, Your Honor, there was no offer of proof to the extent that the offer of proof should go through all of the details that the state believes it should. But I would suggest that just by virtue of the nature of the witness that wasn't there, meaning the rebuttal witness, we can all infer what the purpose of the rebuttal witness would be in a case in which the only issue of fact is the disputed size of a crack. That rebuttal witness is certainly going to be there, not to say that...
It makes it difficult for a reviewing court to make such an inference without an offer of proof. Was there a connection between the rebuttal witnesses and the excluded photographs?
Well, I don't want to go beyond the record, but like I've mentioned, I think that you can fairly infer that a rebuttal witness on this limited set of facts would have been called for the purpose of rebutting whatever the photos might have contained and the new and different and more aggravated description of the crack that came through the testimony of the officer. I do want to talk about the testimony of the officer because I think that you led with the question about what the record really suggests.
Mm-hmm.
My opponent has identified that there is a prior description of the crack as 6 to 8 inches. You juxtapose that with the new description of the crack as something that extends the length of the windshield and up the passenger side, and I think that you have a firm and definite conflict in the evidence. One that, because of credibility concerns, was resolved against the state and in favor of Mr. Cansey. That's a determination that that typically merits great deference on review. And I just want to distinguish this case from Rincon, because in Rincon there was a reversal and a remand because of, I think, there was a notable absence of any findings, a notable absence of any thought or reasoning in the order, and there was no evidentiary hearing conducted. This is the precise opposite of Rincon when you have a nearly 10-page order, thoughtfully drafted, considerate, that hits all the issues and contains all of the necessary findings for this court to conduct review. Remand is inappropriate for that reason. If I can go back to my mistake of law argument, the tension here is that the state seems to suggest that when we're in the mistake of law arena, that the doctrine of waiver simply doesn't apply. This would seem to me to be the only area of law where traditional principles of waiver wouldn't apply. I would submit the waiver applies here just as strongly as it does in other litigation contexts in which the pleading and practice on one side of the courtroom doesn't meet standards of fairness and opportunity. The state does suggest that, well, rationales can't be deemed waived because a district court has a duty, a sua sponte duty, to reach out and do the research, find the applicable legal statute, and then exhaust the universe of other alternatives before it can actually make a determination that this is grounded in a mistake of law. I think that that proves simply too much. If the state doesn't want to go that far with that contention, although I think that that's a fair inference from its arguments in the brief, then it has to concede that if it's not the district court's burden, it is its burden. And if it concedes that it's its burden, then it must concede that when it doesn't carry its burden, it risks its arguments being waived. And that's the fact situation in this case.
In making this argument, Mr. Frey, do you agree that the rule concerning mistake of law articulated by the state is a correct statement of the rule of law as it relates to a mistake of law? example, U.S. versus Wallace, the mistaken application of a statute is not a mistake of law where the conduct observed is actually prohibited by law. Do you agree with that rule?
I would agree that the authorities that are cited by the state, many of which come from California or the New Mexico and the Tenth Circuit, would seem to support that as a general proposition. I've offered one published opinion that proposes an alternative rule. I don't think we need to get to that constitutional issue under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. I think that you don't need to go that far. But I would suggest that indeed the state seems to have assembled authorities that support, as a general proposition, citation of the wrong statute won't per se invalidate a stop if an alternative, arguably correct statute exists.
Well, it's kind of an important issue, isn't it? Because it seems like your argument is, if that's the rule of law, then what's really important in this case is when is the correct statute identified for the court.
That's exactly right.
And your contention is that if it isn't identified in the written opposition papers, then it's waived.
That is the contention. And I do want to highlight, Your Honor, that this is a situation in which the prosecutor didn't even walk into the suppression hearing with the statute in hand. In fact, it was only after a series of concessions that it simply couldn't come up with an alternative legal rationale, where another prosecutor in the audience handed over the bar a note to the attorney, and she argued it for the first time on the spot.
Sort of the opposite of Perry Mason.
I would guess so, Your Honor, but I think it is the absolute epitome of unfair surprise.
Could you address the reasonableness or the appropriateness of excluding the photos and what the defense's position is with respect to prejudice by excluding those?
Certainly, there is a district court rule. It's the local rule.
To clarify, is it true that your client, at least your office, got the photos a week before the hearing?
I was trial counsel. I do remember receiving the photos. I can't tell you exactly when. I believe it was after the close of briefing, but before the hearing. But I can't give you a precise date and time. But I think that is fair to say, yes, we were in possession of the photos prior to the hearing.
How many photos are we talking about?
I can't be sure. It's not in the record, but I can represent to the court that it showed a crack that was consistent with the testimony of the officer.
Well, the main thing is that there was some, it wasn't handed to you at the hearing.
No.
Photos.
No. The argument was given to us at the hearing.
Right, on the citation of the statute, but the photos were right. Sometime before.
With respect to the photos, Your Honor, I understand my opponent's contention to be that it was error to exclude them and that it was somehow without legal basis, but I would point you in the direction of Local Rule of Criminal Practice 7, which requires that every motion or opposition thereto shall be accompanied by a memorandum of legal authorities and any exhibits in support of or in opposition to the motion. This wasn't a decision that was arbitrary or capricious. It was grounded in governing law. And notably, the prosecution didn't move for leave to supplement its pleading. It didn't move at all formally. So even though Mr. Cansey may have had the photos, the district court didn't, putting the district court in a position of unfair surprise as well.
I guess part of the reason for our oral argument here, at least from my point of view, was this issue. I can't ever remember when I was a district court judge seeing exhibits attached to pleading papers on suppression motions. Is that now a practice in the Second District where exhibits to be used at a suppression hearing are to be attached to the pleadings?
Well, it's contained in the rule, Your Honor, and regrettably, I would submit that there are many local rules that are not adhered to. Mm-hmm. We demanded adherence to the local rule. I don't think that's an unreasonable request.
Well, I'm not suggesting that you're incorrect in demanding adherence to local rules if they're applicable. I just was asking about the practice. I thought most exhibits, particularly those that are evidentiary in nature, were introduced with the appropriate foundation and evidentiary rules applied.
It's my general practice to include any exhibits that I have on file in support of the motion. With respect to the prejudice as a result of the photos, Your Honor, the state seems to make the claim that the photos were somehow dispositive or would have materially changed the outcome in this case. And respectfully, I think that's simply wishful thinking because the photos were just cumulative of the testimony of the officer, who said that the crack extended all the way across the windshield and up the passenger side. The photos didn't really add any value to the determination of the district court. Moreover, the conflict in the evidence was firm and definite at that point because you had a prior description of the crack as 68 inches, and then you have this newfound description of the crack as something that's much larger. So the photo wouldn't alleviate that sort of conflict in the evidence. It would reinforce it. Also, the photos themselves were a factor in the impeachment of the officer. The fact that she had to go back 3 months after the arrest, and you can reconstruct the timeline based upon the date of the arrest and the close of briefing. 3 months after the arrest to take photos.
That was my question earlier. Was there any attack to the foundation of this? As 3 month period of time could be significant in the life of a crack in a windshield.
Especially in a tow yard, Your Honor. Open to the elements. That's exactly right. And that was a consideration of the district court.
Was that addressed, the foundation for the photos at the hearing?
There's a proffer, in essence, a proffer after the district court attempted to elicit what these photos might show. The prosecutor noted that, yes, they were produced after, if I could just continue with that thought.
Yeah, sure.
They were produced by the officer after the close of briefing and on the officer's own initiative once she found out that a motion to suppress was pending.
Was there any final point you wish to make, Mr. Frey?
No, if there are no further questions.
A number of questions.
No, I would just request affirmance.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Mr. Plater.
The idea that Mr. Canty was somehow prejudiced because we came up with an alternative legal rationale at the hearing just isn't supported by the record, Your Honors. All we're doing is asking the district court judge a legal question. Given the facts that are before the district court, is there a legal principle that would justify the stop? It's not like we're trying to bring in a bunch of new discovery or introduce new things to justify our position other than asking the court, given the facts that we have, is there a legal rationale that would justify the stop in this case? So we don't see how there could be any prejudice. Now, as to the idea that, well, they were going to subpoena or they were going to offer witnesses in this case, we don't accept the fact that this court can now infer what they would have said. We don't know what they would have said. We can infer perhaps a motive to asking these people to appear in court, but we certainly don't know what they were going to testify to. We've all had a number of hearings in our lives where we expect a certain witness to say a certain thing and they don't say it. So I don't know what those witnesses were going to say. You can't make that inference as to what they were going to say. We're not asking the court in every case, a district court that is, to do the legal research for a particular party and to do the legal work to come up with the correct conclusion. At least in this case, because we already know the legal authority was provided to the district court before it made its decision and before it took any testimony on the case. So it would have been very easy to allow evidence to come in or to allow testimony to have been elicited regarding what was the proper rule to be applied to the facts of this case.
You know, does that encourage or promote mischief by the prosecutor by perhaps citing a wrong statute, getting everybody into the hearing without any other notice and coming in at the last minute and saying, oh, this statute applies instead? Judge, let's make a ruling on this when you're prepared based upon a defense to another statute.
Well, Justice Perrigan, the only thing I think it does is make the prosecutor look bad for not having done their homework and not being adequately prepared. But this court has taken the position that the district court has the obligation to do the right thing. For example, in Rosas, in a case that we cited, this court held that a district court is mandated to give lesser included instructions if there's evidence to support a lesser included offense to the charge offense that the state has charged the defendant on. And assuming that there's some evidence to support it, and there's some evidence that would clear the defendant of the greater charge, the district court has a sua sponte duty of doing that. We think that duty applies to the district court just as well, in cases where, especially where a motion to suppress is at issue. Because certainly the public has an interest just as well as the defendant has a right in his constitutional rights to prosecute people who violate the laws of the state. So we'd ask you to reverse the district court order granting the motion to suppress.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your briefing in this matter and your excellent arguments here today, and the matter will stand submitted.